People want to dive into AI because it's the sexy buzzword, but AI can work very well for some things and maybe not so well for others, just like any other technology out there. And so we don't treat it as a bit of magic. We treat it as a combination of data science and software engineering in a very pragmatic sense.
Welcome to the AI Element. I'm Alex Shi, and the person you just heard is Chris Benson, chief scientist at one of Honeywell's global divisions. We spoke to Chris about how AI is transforming logistics and manufacturing and the job of factory workers in general. But before we get to that, let's dig a bit more into the distinction he made at the top of the show. The difference between companies seeing AI as a magic wand to wave at business problems versus companies that see AI more pragmatically.
With machine learning, you train it based on historical data. It does something. But then once you put it into the wild, the parameters that you trained it for, you know, if it's, I want it to be a prediction that's within 5% of accuracy, as soon as you put it into the wild with real data, it starts to change and it strays, right? So you have to keep making sure that that model stays up to date. You have to keep retraining it. You have to keep an eye on it. I always say it's almost like a child that you train, you bring them up, and then you put them out into the real world and they're like, oh, start hanging around with the wrong people. You're like, yeah, let me retrain you. They make sure that you're going to stick on the right path.
As a director at Element AI, Naomi Goldapple talks to executives from Fortune 100 companies about this on a regular basis. What's an AI strategy? Why should the C-suite embrace this tech?
So we created a methodology to do an AI strategy, and that involves sort of teasing out from the companies what is important to them. We would kind of like catalog all their processes, see what kind of access they had to data, what is the state of the data, and then do a sort of prioritization exercise to see what is the lowest hanging fruit, where can we start, and then what would be your roadmap for the next 3 to 5 years. The idea is where can they start using AI technologies as a leverage for whatever their business goal is. So it was very important to make sure that we're not going to come in and tell you what your business strategy should be. We're just going to tell you how you can use AI, how you can leverage it to get to your business strategy. Like, what are different ways that can maybe open up new markets, that can contain your costs better, that can actually disrupt industries if you're in a declining industry.
So you're going into these companies and you already have a kind of a brief background into how they want to use AI. So what's your role in that, like the scientist's role?
When you don't have access to that deep knowledge and people that have worked with the technologies and have actually worked applying those technologies, then you have less understanding on what is really feasible today. So when we start to understand what are the opportunities that our potential clients have identified, then the PhDs, the applied research scientists, they go and they do scans to see where is the research at today, what are the solved problems, what are the limitations of the technology today, because we can know what is possible today, but then what is at the cusp of sort of technological breakthroughs. So what should you be thinking about in the sort of medium term?
How do companies adopt an AI-first attitude or strategy and then actually implement it? What are some of the key elements that they need to have top of mind?
Some of them have gone about it wrong, yeah, in a wrong way, where it's almost like an AI hammer looking for a nail. They're just like, I got to do something AI. So some companies have come to us. They're like, listen, we've identified this project. It's an AI one and we want you to do it. And we're like, huh, I don't know if that would be like the low hanging fruit, if that is the project that would make sense as your foray into AI. And some of them have tripped up on it where like, you know what, that didn't make sense. And then we have to see what is really strategic, like what would be a building block for you guys.
So how would you advise company executives? Where should they start?
So I'm working with a Fortune 100 right now, and they started saying, here are the 6 things that we want to do with AI. And we're like, great, they already know what they want to do. And as now we're digging into the things that they say what they want to do, we're like, well, what about this? And they're like, wait, we forgot this, we forgot that. And we're like, hey, you know what? Now it's getting to be a lot of patchwork. And we want to make sure that all these projects are going to link together to create some sort of like a system of intelligence for the for the entire organization. Like, they're all going to start to link together in this big AI brain. But if you're doing a bunch of disparate projects, you almost end up having, like, I call them proof of concept droppings, you know, like all over, where that aren't linked together and aren't actually going to help the company move forward. So it's good to have that overall strategy on where you can couch all of these different projects to make sure that they're all on the same, they're all moving in the right direction.
You know, in terms of your experience, what has been the biggest barrier for companies to actually adopt an AI first strategy?
So a lot of companies, look, they keep their IP, their intellectual property close to their chest, and they've been very used to doing that for very long. So the idea of even sharing data and allowing it to be used for training purposes, to be able to train systems, is very difficult. What people have to understand is that the way software used to be built was really a deterministic point of view, where you would say, this is what I need my software to do. You would hire a company, they would write you some code based on a bunch of rules, they would deliver it to you, and it would do that for here ever and ever after. With machine learning, it's like it's a relationship. It's something that the software is going to continue to evolve because the machines are going to continue to learn. And so the organization has to be like in a state of evolution as opposed to this is what I have and this is what it's going to be forever after. So it's a whole different mindset. You have to understand that what you're buying today isn't necessarily what it's going to be in a little while. And you have to understand that you have to be flexible with that.
Getting executive buy-in is a key part of an AI strategy. But luckily for Chris Benson, this part came easy. Chris was hired at Honeywell to help inject artificial intelligence into traditional, but transforming manufacturing and logistics space.
So my name is Chris Benson. I am the chief scientist at one of Honeywell's global divisions.
Honeywell is a multinational conglomerate company that produces a variety of commercial and consumer products for a wide variety of customers, from private consumers to major corps and government.
My job is to organize, create all of the artificial intelligence and machine learning features that go into our products. And I work with product teams or new products that we are taking to market. And my team collaborates with those product development teams to introduce intelligence into those products.
We asked Chris how he got into AI to begin with.
Way back 25 years ago, I was introduced to artificial intelligence. I was actually not a data scientist, but more of a software engineer. Coming through college, my parents worked for Lockheed, and they worked for the F-22 project. And there was an event back in 1992 at Edwards Air Force Base when they were testing one of the two prototypes. And you could actually find this out on YouTube, where the YF-22 was being tested by a pilot, test pilot, and he was deliberately trying to crash the plane because the avionics of the plane were intended to prevent him from being able to crash it. Unfortunately, the avionics did not succeed, and from fairly low, not far off the runway, he was successfully able to crash the plane, which was obviously a failure. And the plane went sliding at high speed down the runway, and the pilot was fine, escaped the fire and everything, no problem. But the engineer who was assigned to tackle that was my father. And so I had this back in the early 90s, I had this introduction to the space when he started looking into neural networks to tackle this engineering problem with avionics. And so I got a very early introduction on a day-to-day basis for over about a year as he was using neural network technology of the day to do it.
Many years later, Chris is doing the same thing at Honeywell. In spite of being a large company to the tune of over 100,000 employees, Honeywell is shaking up manufacturing and logistics by fully embracing AI.
You can only make it so far when you're trying to create great products to help the world do what they do. And so the thing that AI has done is it's given us a more powerful toolbox. It is kind of augmented the existing toolboxes that we use in terms of creating these products and envisioning what they might be able to do in a practical and realistic sense. And it's given us a whole new set of capabilities to apply.
This toolbox is helping Chris and his team from the Safety and Productivity Solutions Division at Honeywell make workplaces more safe and more efficient.
So there are a lot of areas that safety and productivity solutions hits, everywhere from focusing on what we call workforce solutions, which is kind of enhancing a worker to be able to do their job better, to making a company, making their logistics, their warehouse operations much more efficient. And that's a big part of what I focus on right now at Honeywell. Is looking at those logistical warehouse situations and saying, what can we do? We have that worker that is doing a job, and what could we do to make her job better and make her better able to do it, and her able to add value to the company and enhance the value of her job?
Chris shared some tangible examples of what exactly is being optimized.
So those physical, tangible goods and services, the things we're buying as Christmas gifts, you know, every year, and birthday gifts and other such things, those are real goods. Those are things that we take into our house and set down at our kitchen table. And those have to be moved all over the globe. And there is obviously giant network of transportation and logistics infrastructure that does that. So the limiting factors that affect that are everything from inventory and understanding logistically where you should put different packages within a warehouse, how they should be organized, how they should be moved around, how the workers in that warehouse interact with those. What tools do they have? Is it manual? Is it automated? And so there's a whole spectrum of technology tools that you can apply. And one of those kind of high-end tool sets is our AI toolbox.
Chris explained that at a high level, AI should be used in scenarios where it can provide value or cut costs.
It's really important to say, I have a set of very useful tools, and I have a set of use cases that I am trying to solve for, to either create a new capability in the form of a product or to enhance something that we are already doing. Honeywell has a line of speech recognition devices where you can put on a headset, and they can be, it's a little bit different from what you might think of with like an iPhone and Siri, and that it is designed for that environment specifically. And in many cases, such as the logistics for warehouses are big. There are lots of dangerous things that can be moving around to a human being, large containers. And you want to ensure that a worker that's out there doing their job in that warehouse is both safe and can be as productive as possible, which requires lots of communication between that worker and other workers, as well as that worker and the automated systems that the warehouse may have around. And so we tackle it from both sides. We try to make more intelligent automated systems, and we try to enable that worker with the tools that they need to interface with those systems in the most efficient and safe manner possible.
In other words, tech is helping humans and robots talk to one another.
You have natural language processing, and then you also have natural language understanding, to where the context of what you're talking about is understood by an automated system. So right now, you have to be very, very precise in your interactions with a system, and your methods of interaction may be somewhat limited to a very specific script. But going forward in time, systems, as they become more and more intelligent, will be able to interact with a person who might be wearing a headset. And I'll kind of throw out a hypothetical use case where that person is on a warehouse floor. They are responsible for a complex set of interactions in terms of moving different packaging around and using different machines within the warehouse and they're kind of orchestrating that.
So just as today you ask Alexa for the weather, the factory worker of the future might use voice commands to work the machinery in the warehouse.
As a worker, I might want to just talk. I might want to say, move that. Let's move this, and have the systems to some degree even figure out which system you're talking to based on your orientation with the headset, which way you're facing. If you add in machine vision, then you might point at something. And as you point at the finger and you have your speech saying, I want to move that to there.
All of this paints quite an exciting picture for the future of logistics and manufacturing, but Chris insists that all the applications today are quite narrow in scope.
AI, as we are looking at it today and in the foreseeable future, meaning measurable future right now, it doesn't replace a human brain. So today, AI is specific to very precise use cases. So there's an exact task I want to do, and I can train up a neural network to take all the things that may influence that task, all the inputs to that task, and assess those better than a human being could for that exact task. But that's an incredibly narrow focus for that neural network. And if I want to do multiple tasks, I've got to have that. I got to have a specific neural network that handles each of those things, and I have to have a computer system that knows how to manage those different models and interoperate between them. It is what we are looking at in today's use cases are not scary things.
Naomi echoed this sentiment.
I mean, there's a lot of, you know, there's always one in every crowd that's going to talk to you about, you know, killer robots and, you know, Skynet and, you know, like the Elon Musks and the Stephen Hawking's don't help with, yeah. You know, putting fear into people. So there's always dispelling and having people understand that where we are at today is really in a world of very narrow AI. We're not at a state of general AI where it could just make these decisions all by itself and, you know, turn against you. And that's, we're really, really not there. So there's a lot of hype and a lot of worry about job loss and the danger. But they're very easy to dispel. That type of stuff, especially about job loss, because people, when you're in big organizations, they get worried that they're going to be automated out of a job. But I always tell them, you know, look, 10 years ago, a bunch of the jobs that exist today didn't exist in 10 years, didn't exist 5 years ago, right? So you have all kinds of stuff. I mean, you know, Uber drivers, those people didn't exist. Social media managers, like there's a whole bunch of jobs that didn't exist. So jobs that are repeatable, tedious, perhaps dangerous, those can be eliminated and they can create more meaningful work for people. And so having that conversation is always important, and it puts people, I find it brings their guard down to be able to talk about it, especially when you're talking to the people who actually do the work.
And if you had a listener that was wondering, should I embark on this kind of journey to integrate AI and to have an AI strategy and to actually start doing it, what would you tell them?
It's really beneficial to look at how can this new technology that is really can be very transformative, how can we be taking advantage of this in the right way? And in a way that we're doing it like in baby steps, so that the organization can learn along and that we can do change management at the same time. Because one thing that AI does require is participation of the humans, right? Because it really augments what humans do, and humans have to learn how to work with the AI, how to trust it.
Naomi shared an example of how she used AI-first design as a tool to establish trust between workers and new AI.
So, you know, an example of AI-first design, I'll give you a really concrete example right now. So we're working with a big port, right? So one of the problems that this port came to us about was the truckers that are coming in every day to unload containers and pick up containers from the ships that are coming in, they have a long wait time to get into the port. And right now, the wait time is too long, and the accuracy of the predictions that they give them for what the wait time is going to be is off. Right. So when the dispatchers are planning the day for the truckers and they want them to do three trips, like go and drop off and pick up containers three times a day, they're basing it on what the wait times are going to be. So they said they can't plan their day because the wait times are so off. So we've built an algorithm to better predict how long the wait time is going to be based on many different factors around, including, you know, when the ships are coming in, how many containers are left on the ground, when are the trains passing, what's the weather like, all kinds of stuff. You throw those into AI models and it will give you the answer. And we were able to really improve the accuracy of the predictions. Now, who are the consumers of these predictions? They're dispatchers and truck drivers. So these are people that are used to looking at what they're in their trucks. How are they going to actually consume this? So you have to think they're probably going to be on their phones or on some sort of a brick or a tablet. How are they going to look at that? If I tell them, you know what, your wait time is going to be 17 minutes and then they end up waiting 38 minutes, they're going to get pissed off and they're never going to trust it again. So you really have one chance, right? And so probably putting an exact number, right, an absolute number in there probably isn't a good way of doing it. What's the best way for them to consume that? Maybe Maybe it's more of like an arrow that's trending green up or an arrow that's trending red down, showing that it's improving or increasing, or it's, you know, the wait time is getting more or less. So it's very important to talk to them, to give them some options on how they can consume this so that they believe it and so that it starts to be part of how they plan their days. So this is really, really important. You can have the most amazing model that gives you the best predictions, but if you display it to people in a way that is not credible or is not, doesn't work with their flow of their work, they're never going to trust it and they're not going to use it. So it's very important to think about how the human is interacting with it.
Chris has seen firsthand the power of that mutually beneficial relationship between AI and workers. He's seen the effect that AI can have today. It's not about automating tasks that humans do, but it's about augmenting.
So when I go to work every day and I'm thinking about how do I empower these workers, I'm not thinking I want to make a bunch of workers go away. That's not in my head when I'm doing that, and that's not my goal. My job is to make every one of those workers supercharged and more empowered. Humans aren't going out of the equation. The key here is to take things that humans don't really need to do and take that amazing, the most amazing machine in the entire process is that human being. And you know, they have a human brain, which we haven't even come close yet to matching in terms of computing capabilities and stuff. So I value that human being in the process, and I want to give that human being the best opportunities to do the most important things, and let the low end stuff get automated away and stuff, so that human is better enabled to do their job. Automation is not always a bad thing when you're still making it better for the worker. You're keeping them from having, you know, joint issues, from trying to struggle with large containers that the human body was never intended to do. And if you can have a robot that can help them do that, and that person says, I want to move this around, and the robot basically gives them muscles that they never could have had in the real world, that's an amazing thing you've done for that person. They go home at night and they see their children and their family, and she's able to say, I had an amazing day at work, and they feel good and they're not going to a doctor about their aches and pains. I love that.
As always, you can tweet at me at @IAmAlexShi. If you like this episode, please subscribe. The AI Element is produced by Steph Colburn at Edit Audio and Amanda Durupo at Element AI. Special thanks to Simon Hudson, Erica Kanna, Jacob Schreier, Weiwei Lin, Geneviève Jacquevelle-Rémiard, Katie Yam, Christophe Coutel, and Caroline Bourbagnin. Our theme music was by Bienna. You can find out more about each episode at elementai.com/podcast.